Good afternoon. It's almost 3 p.m. You're listening to KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. I'm Ken Fix. I'll be your host for a Juneau afternoon today. On today's show, we'll talk with Bill Diebels about tonight's Essential Tremors Support Group meeting. Carol Biggs will be here to highlight her nature walks. We'll talk with Dove Gardenberg about the NAMI family-to-family sessions beginning this summer. And we'll hear an original story by former Tongass National Forest District Ranger Pete Griffin. All this, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more for Tuesday, June 17th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The public comment period for the Bureau of Indian Affairs draft proposal on federal acknowledgement ends in July, and as Melinda Tuhus reports, Connecticut's governor has sent a letter to the Obama administration asking that three state-recognized tribes not qualify.
The new proposal calls for a tribe to show, quote, community and political influence and authority from 1934 to the present, unquote, instead of since 1789. The rules would also eliminate the requirement that an external entity identify the group as Indian from 1900 to the present. In his letter, Governor Malloy claimed that three state-recognized tribes, the Scaticoke Tribal Nation, the Eastern Pequots, and the Golden Hill Pagussets, did not meet the already existing criteria, but that the Scaticokes and Eastern Pequots were initially granted federal recognition a decade ago, quote, because Connecticut's maintenance of reservations implied that the state recognized the groups as a political tribal entity, unquote. The state won both rulings on appeal, and federal recognition was withdrawn. Malloy said federal recognition could be devastating, allowing the tribes to pursue land claims, open casinos, and take land off the tax rolls. In response to Malloy's appeal, the final draft wording requires tribes whose bids for federal recognition have been rejected to get approval from any third parties who previously opposed their recognition. Scaticoke Chief Richard Velke is angered by the governor's actions.
The state made themselves the third party involved, even though the state had the responsibility of our tribes for centuries, that they still are now considered a third party that can stop the tribe from gaining its federal recognition. The same people that there was there to protect us are now there to hurt us.
Eugene Fidel is an expert on Indian law at Yale Law School in New Haven. He says that while he has great respect for Governor Malloy,
I must say I am uncomfortable with the idea that the state or any other third party might have a veto over what really is supposed to be an executive decision by the federal government. If the state has an objection to the quality of the evidence that any state-recognized tribe is able to muster, then let the state come forward with its evidence. Let the state raise questions. But the idea of having the state have its finger on a veto switch, I think is very difficult to justify.
Melinda Tuhus, National Native News, New Haven.
Northern Plains tribes are hit with a period of heavy rain. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt has more.
The Winnebago and Omaha reservations in northeast Nebraska and Flandreau Santee Sioux and Yankton Sioux tribal lands in South Dakota have had several periods of heavy rain in the past couple of weeks. Some locations received nearly 8 inches of rain on Monday. Brad Tiemeyer with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, says the same setup that caused problems Monday could repeat itself today.
It's still somewhat uncertain whether those actually will occur or not. But if they do, they would be very similar to what we've seen over the last few days. Probably a lesser tornado threat, but still looking at the potential for hail and high winds and also the potential for heavy rains.
South Dakota officials closed Interstate 29 in southeast South Dakota and several state highways Monday night. Flood warnings and advisories are in effect on several spots on the northern plains. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
In June 2012, Google and dozens of organizations launched a website to help with language revitalization efforts. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Supported by Sacred Wind Community Connect, providing scholarships and internet training to the Navajo Nation in Pueblo of Laguna in New Mexico. Sacred Wind believes broadband can reinforce Native cultures and offer means for self-determination. SacredWindCommunications.com. With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And my first guest today in the studio is Bill Diebels, and he's going to be talking about tonight's Essential Tremors Support Group meeting. Good afternoon, Bill. How are you?
Good afternoon, Ken. It's great to be here.
Okay. First, let's enlighten our audience and describe what exactly is Essential Tremors.
You know, Essential Tremors is probably one of the most common movement disorders, and probably the least known about and the least understood. What it is it's a tremor, it's a shaking, and it's generally of the hands or the fingers, and but sometimes it can be the arms, the head, even the lower trunk. But it's called essential tremor now, and you know, it used to be called a benign intention tremor. And it used to be called, what else is it called? It's called familial tremor because it seems to run in families. But when I say it's kind of little known about, it's because so many people seem to have it. For instance, there are about 10 million people in the United States that have essential tremor. And I did the math to try to, you know, extrapolate what that would be in Juneau. And so that would be over 900 people. And based on my experience and a lot of people's experiences, not only do a lot of people who don't have this problem know about it, but a lot of the people who have it don't know about it. They wonder, what's wrong with them? I shake, you know. I'm not nervous. I'm not scared. I just shake. And so it's something that they kind of tend to sometimes minimize, hide a little bit. And you can get it at any time in your life. For instance, I first got essential tremor. I say I have had it as long as I can remember, but in reality it was probably around 10 years old or something. And it's more unusual for a young child to get it, but it's tougher, I think, for a young child, because you get on the playground, you know, and the kids are saying that, hey, what's bad, Billy? You nervous? What's going on? You don't know what's going on. So I was well into adulthood before I understood what was going on, and that's the case with a lot of people. So that's really my motivation for getting some word out and some understanding and some appreciation and some support of activities that can help this issue.
Researching the topic, I discovered that half of the cases are genetic.
That's right, about 50%. My father had it, and I really didn't know it until very much later, but now when I think back the way he wrote, you know, he would sign his name like two letters at a time, kind of get those two letters out and then two more like that. And my sister had it. She could hardly get food to her mouth. And it more tends to occur with people later in life. I mean, as you get older, you get it probably in the 50s to 60s when it starts appearing more. There's kind of a hump there, although it can come any time. And it tends to get worse as it goes along.
Okay, and would you be able to discuss a little bit about the tests that are done you know, that are associated with this?
The
because
what?
Because tests that are done to verify what you've got, because some people might shake because their blood sugar is low. So, I mean, you know, I've had that where it's like, oh, man, I need to get something in me because, you know, my blood sugar is low. I'm shaking a little bit.
Right. There's not really refined tests, but there's a lot of evidence just based on how the tremor works. A lot of people tend to confuse it with Parkinson's disease, which has a tremor. But pretty easy to divide that Parkinson's tremor will be at rest. So if a Parkinson's patient's hand is on his leg or knee, it'll often tremor. This essential tremor used to be called intention tremor, because when you had an intention, I'm demonstrating now, picking up this bottle of water, doing anything that's the finer the movements, the more the tremor occurs. And that's basically one of the easier ways to diagnose it. It's a neurological problem. It's in the brain. And so it's usually handled by neurologists. There are some medications that help some of the time. None of the medications have been developed specifically for essential tremor. But there are some that have been used for other problems, beta blockers and so on, which I happen to find is pretty good for me. Doesn't help everybody, but you do the best you can.
And you said that you first noticed this when you were like 10. When do most people sort of notice symptoms? Is it usually later in their 40s or 50s?
Yeah, it tends to come with older age, and the older people get, the more likely they're going to have them. What amazes me more than anything else is that so many people that have essential tremor still don't know what it is. And when they realize it, it's kind of nice to know I've got something that's identifiable in a way. I see people every once in a while, like in a restaurant or something. And if I have the opportunity, I'll say, and they're shaking, you know, and I'll say, oh, you got what I got. And boy, I get this look, what are you talking about, you know. And then I quickly get into what it is, and you'd be surprised how many people are so relieved. And then we get talking about it. So that just kind of reinforces for me the value of having a group to get together and discuss the information, experiences, strategies, that sort of thing.
Okay, that would bring up what I was going to ask next, which was what sort of topics would you discuss in a group? Is it more or less relating to the same condition with others, or are you kind of saying, hey, this works for me to help alleviate my symptoms, and you might want to think about trying this or getting to a doctor and seeing if they'll prescribe this for you?
Yeah, I think all of the above. You know, it's always good to share with somebody who understands what you're developing. And along with that, then you get strategies, you know, how to handle things. And there are a lot of coping mechanisms that people either find out about or discover on their own. And then the information. And then as a group, we would also be interested in the world being educated, you know, about this thing, so that there'd be more understanding about that condition.
All right. And Bill, would you remind everybody the meeting is tonight? Tell everybody where it's going to be.
Yes, I certainly would. This is kind of short notice, but if you're interested in, if you have, we call it ET, essential tremor, sure show up. This is kind of an organizational meeting, but we'll have some information and things to talk about. The meeting is at the hospital, not in the hospital, but at the administration building. You know, when you drive up the hill there, the first building on the left is a building separate from the hospital, and that's where it is. It's in room 203B, like in Baker. It's at 6:30. I think we'll run for an hour about, and So you better hurry up because you got about 3 hours to get there.
Yeah,
you know,
and that'd be good. Right after work thing.
And if I just have one, if anybody wants to give me a call about this meeting or at any time wants information, I'd be glad to hear from them. And my number is 321-7586. One final thing, if you...
Oh, of course. I was going to say, tell them the website address.
Want to get it all in there. Yeah, if you get on the website and... if you get on the web and Google essential tremor, you get a lot of information. And from my point of view, there's one excellent organization that has been helping me along what I'm trying to do here, and it's called the Essential Tremor Organization. So it's Essential Tremor, all one word, .org. Ken, thanks a lot.
All right, Bill Diebels, thank you very much for being our guest on the Juno Afternoon today. And since it's so windy out, before my next guest, Chris Taylor from Canvas, will pop in here to talk just a little bit, it's kind of windy, so I'm going to play Windy from the Association.
North and KTOO want to let you know about our new multimedia project, A Roof, a year-long look at housing and homelessness in Alaska. We'll look at trends, costs, and solutions to the state's housing and homelessness issues. The idea behind A Roof is that everyone deserves a roof over their head. Check out our project at 360north.org and tweet us ideas with the hashtag AKRoof. A Roof, a new multimedia project from 360 North and KTOO.
319, and you're listening to KTOO in Juneau. My next guest is getting pinched in between a couple here, but it's Chris Taylor from Canvas, and he's here to talk about the landscape workshop. Yeah. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Great.
Great. Yeah, I just kind of wanted to jump on and talk a little bit about a workshop that we have. It's a landscape painting workshop by Linda Infantes-Lyon. She's an Anchorage artist that we're flying down to host and teach this workshop. The workshop is starting July 16th, so it'll go the 16th through the 20th. It'll be a five-day workshop. The first 3 days will be from 6 to 9 o'clock, so a good 3 hours a night. And then the last 2 days will be on that the 19th and the 20th, which is Saturday and Sunday, and that'll go. Both of those sessions will go from 11 to 4, and should be just about 20 hours of good solid time with this instructor, and you'll be going over the basic processes of landscape painting and focusing predominantly on color and trying to get atmosphere and mood through the use of color in landscape painting. Should be a very interesting class. The class is open to all skill levels and abilities. She's a very talented painter, so you know if you're a beginner, it'd be a great class to jump in on. And if you're a more experienced painter, Linda has quite a list of accomplishments that would be great for any artist to kind of touch base with her and take a class with her. She's got collection pieces in the collection at the Anchorage Museum. She does a lot of workshops in Anchorage, a lot of 1% for the arts. She's a Rasmussen Award winner last year and very, very talented teacher.
All right. And again, this is in July. This is not That's June. Correct. It's a month from
it's
now.
It's a month from now, yes. And we have limited space. We have 10 spaces available, and we currently have 5 of them already filled. So it's filling up quick, but I thought I'd kind of spread the word and let other people know if they're interested. We have a great
teacher
coming.
We'll get the last 5 people in here. All right. And if anybody wants more information, where should they go?
They should either go to our website, which is www.canvasartswithans.org, or give us a call at 907-586-1750 or stop in at 223 Seward Street, and we'll be there to help you out, get you signed up, answer questions.
So if you always wanted to paint landscapes, this is your chance to get some professional instruction.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
All right. Very good. Chris Taylor from Canvas, thank you very much for being our guest today.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 17th of June, 2014. It was on this day in 1901 that the first standardized tests were administered by the College Board for college admission. Before the standardized test came along, many universities had their own college entrance exams, but the number of college students had grown rapidly between 1890 and 1900, and the founders of the College Board thought having a standardized test would help to simplify curricula at the high school level and make a college education accessible to a wider pool of applicants. And so the tests were given. They were tested in English, French, German, Latin, Greek, history, mathematics, chemistry, and physics. And the tests were essays. They were not multiple choice. So the first college boards were achievement tests. They tested students' proficiency in certain subjects. And a couple of decades later, the College Board switched over to aptitude tests intended to measure intelligence, just in case your high school did not teach ancient Greek. But one motive for the aptitude test was to limit the influx of immigrants and particularly Eastern European Jews to the student bodies of Ivy League schools. A dean at Columbia University thought the high numbers of recent immigrants and their children would make the school, quote, socially uninviting to students who come from homes of refinement. These college officials believed that immigrants had less innate intelligence than old blood Americans and would score lower on aptitude tests, which would give the schools an excuse to admit fewer of them. But it simply turned out not to be true. In any case, the new aptitude tests were known as the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the SAT, and the first was given in 1926. It's the birthday of the poet Ron Padgett, born Tulsa, 1942, the son of a bootlegger. And it's the birthday of John Hersey, born in Tianjin, China, to American missionaries in 1914, whose nonfiction piece, Hiroshima, 31,000 words long, appeared in the New Yorker magazine on August 31, 1946, a magazine with a cover featuring a picnic scene with people sunbathing and swimming and playing mandolins. Hersey's piece took up the entire issue of the magazine. Here's a poem for today by Tom Chandler entitled So Much Depends Upon. The blonde woman who drops a potato in the supermarket parking lot where it rolls beneath the 89 Dodge Ram with rust patches near the left rear fender from contact with too much road salt during the winter of 91, which was actually one of the mildest on record, though the driver tends to remember it as the season he was fired from his job at the aluminum window factory where he had worked for nearly 16 years without promotion as he shifts into reverse and backs over the potato, which squishes as softly as a dream's last breath and leaves slick asphalt for the lot boy to slip on as he pushes a train of shopping carts and sprains his lumbar vertebrae just days before he is scheduled to leave for basic training to become the cool killing machine he's always craved, but will now have to settle for someday making assistant produce manager and marrying a girl he almost loves, just as the blonde woman finds herself one potato short with dinner guests ringing the doorbell. Tom Chandler's poem, So Much Depends Upon, from his collection Toy Firing Squad, published by Wind Publications and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
My name is Kathy Allen. I'm a volunteer who hosts Thursday morning soundings on KRNN. The reason I really like KRNN is because it is the very best choice in Juneau for favorites of mine like classic rock, world music, and blues. Tune in to KRNN 102.7 FM or krnn.org.
And it's 3:27 p.m. in the capital city of Juneau. You're listening to KRNN 104.3, almost said 102.7. That's the other station, KRNN. But my guest now in the studio is Carol Biggs, and she's here to highlight her nature walks. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the studio.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Carol Biggs. I'm the owner of Alaska Nature Connection and Counselor Without Walls. It's a all-nature-centered business, nature counseling and nature educating. One of the highlights of what I do is wild edible and medicinal plant classes, and I operate from the process of natural succession and how plants colonize the land from the recession of the glacier. We're lucky to have that kind of situation here where we can walk right out there and find out what plants show up after the rocks show up underneath the glacier. And it's a very intelligent, natural order of things. You can tell the first plants that come in are the nitrogen fixers like the fireweed and the willows and the alders. And, well, first, the first thing that happens is that lichens leach minerals from down in the rocks, and they prepare the way for some mosses that show up, and then little birds fly along or the winds blow and seedlings drop into the moss and the lichen, and they start forming dirt for plants to then start colonizing the land. And once one knows about this process, anywhere that you are, you're going to know approximately the age of the forest and what kind of plants will be there. And you don't have to go looking for a subalpine or alpine plant if you're in the old growth forest at sea level, because it's not going to be there. The way I like to present my classes is based on, and the way I have learned myself, I'm not a botanist. My field, my master's degree is in eco-psychology, and I operate from natural attraction. So, for instance, one year I was really attracted over to a little community of purple cone-like flowers. That was the first time I noticed them. They were in a community, and so I just watched them for the whole season. I didn't know what the plant's name was. I didn't know anything about it. And pretty soon I started gaining. I got information based on the habitat, the home that it liked, and the surrounding plants. It was actually a roadside plant that liked disturbed soil, but that's not the only place that it likes to live. But I found out that it was self-heal or all-heal, so it goes around. Ultimately, I finally looked in the books after I got a sense for my own exercising at least a minimum of 20 of the at least 53 natural senses that we were born with. And another class that I teach is that class, Nature Through at Least 53 Natural Senses. And the fact that we have not been educated to think in those terms, we miss about 95% of our lives. Most of us operate in about three senses, the senses of reason, language, and sight. So most of the time our minds are going on and on and on, nonstop. There's always some words going on in our minds. And I have activities that were designed by the head of the program that I went through, Michael Cohen of Project Nature Connect, who is a biologist, a psychologist, and a teacher, and who has been living outside pretty much where he's year-round for maybe 55 years or so. He sleeps outdoors every night. He's on San Juan Island. But he took a bunch of... He had an outdoor school that was based on nature-centered cultures and natural learning. In fact, Frankie Pelafont of our community, who was on the assembly, was one of his students. And they toured around the country in a school bus and learned from natural systems and natural cultures. And Frankie is the one who started the charter school here, as a matter of fact, because using that experience-based educational system. So when I take people out, the first thing I do is have them start getting present at a class of, say, wild, edible, and medicinal plants by following an attraction, and from which they learn something right away about what not only the plant itself, but what senses might be being nourished inside of them. And I operate from the point of view that everything in nature is nourishing and everything is interrelated. And so when I'm walking along North Douglas Road and I'm literally breathing in all the plant life and a lot of certainly the salt water, so I'm really taking in more than just a plant that I might ingest. I'm taking in the environment in which it grew as well. And so I can adapt my classes to just about anything, because nature is that versatile, and I'm the facilitator. I am not the teacher. I am not the counselor. Nature is. And I take people out for a therapeutic nature walks where sometimes people who have been traumatized in early life, nature is the best therapist that we have. And it's been around for a few billion years at least, and helping people in every way, if we're open to being present in the moment, most of which we are not. most of the time. So going for a walk, even I, when I'm not doing my own activities, takes me a walk, probably 2 miles to get present of a walk. So, but it's worth it because nature has all the answers. We are nature, and we have the potential to learn about our journey from our own interactions and engagements in our moment-by-moment connections if we take the time to do that. Guaranteed to be healing and nourishing, and it's endlessly fascinating, and it will take us through lifetimes of wisdom.
All right, Carol, I wanted to ask you a question. As far as from the point of glacial retreat to forestation, what kind of time frame are we looking at to where we get lichen moves in and small plants start moving in and they create the bed for a forest to materialize? What kind of time frame are we looking at in years?
It's a good question. And it takes a long time. For instance, the old growth forest out on North Douglas is the way the land is colonized is first the plants that come in, they put something in the soil for the next succession of plants, like the nitrogen fixers. And out by the glacier, there's not many trees. The willows, the cottonwoods, and the alders are the main trees around. Then down by the river, across the highway over to the Brotherhood Bridge Trail, I think that's probably around, I didn't bring that piece of information with me, but it takes thousands of years, actually. It can take hundreds of years for the spruce to start overtopping the cottonwoods. And everybody, all the plants are geared toward getting into the sun. So the cottonwoods, they like water, and so pretty soon they're overtopping the alders and the willows, and then the spruce starts growing up amidst little seedlings are growing up, and pretty soon they can grow taller, so they eventually outgrow the cottonwoods and the old growth forest, the real old growth forest where some of those hemlocks over on North Douglas can be hundreds of 400 years old or more. And that's where my favorite part of the forest, those gentle hemlocks that are very old and very soft. And it's just, that's the kind of energy I experience there. There is a chart in one of our several of our authors around here, Bob Armstrong, and anyway, there's a Southeast Alaska book, and that there's a chart in there that identifies all the ages of the forest. So it's a good question. I don't have exact precise.
All right, Carol, as far as your nature walks go, when do you conduct them, and how does somebody get a hold of you if they want to be part of it?
I'm going to be teaching wild edible and medicinal plant classes throughout the summer, and I have some flyers out, but my phone number, do you want that information? People can call
me.
Sure,
if there's a website or email address, that would be fabulous.
Yeah, there's the website only has the covers of my plant guides, my wild edible and medicinal plant pocket trail guides, but it's www.alaska.net/tilda, AK Nature. It's an old web page. But my email is aknature@alaska.net, and my phone number is 586-2453. And I will be teaching in the fall and winter. I do natural therapeutic walks for health and stress management and for just generally tending to what we need to nourish ourselves.
All right. Well, Carol Biggs, thank you very much for being our guest on the Juno Afternoon today.
And thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.
Hey, kids, let's go for a walk.
Yeah!
There's a place that I know where I like to go. The rivers are run so crystal clear, and the trees are growing tall, and the critters have it all, and wild birds are all that you hear. Come walk with me,
come walk with me,
through the big pine trees,
through the big pine trees,
from the mountain tops,
from the mountain tops,
to the shining sea,
to the shining sea,
where the critters roam,
where the critters roam,
free and on their own,
free and on their own,
in the wilderness,
in the wilderness,
we'll be right at home,
we'll be right at home.
It's where the grizzly roams his high mountain home. He's looking for his pine nuts and his berries. Oh, he likes to have his fun, he likes laying in the sun, but to some folks he's still a bit too scary. Come walk with me,
come walk with me,
through the big pine trees,
through the big pine trees,
from the mountain tops,
from the mountain tops,
to the shining sea,
to the shining sea,
where the critters roam,
where the critters roam,
free and on their own,
free and on their own,
in the wilderness,
in the wilderness,
we'll be right at home.
We'll be right at home.
It's where life is free to live and breathe and be. Everything just has a special place. Big and small, they get by. Some eat, some sleep, some die. Some even have a smile on their face. Come walk with me.
Come walk with me.
Through the big pine trees,
through the big pine trees,
from the mountain tops,
from the mountain tops,
to the shining
seas, to the shining seas,
where the critters roam,
where the critters roam,
free and on their own,
free and on their own,
in the wilderness,
in the wilderness,
we'll be right at home.
Well, that was part of Jim Stoltz's song, Walk With Me, and it's from a CD called A Kid for the Wild. Well, kind of chimed in with Carol Biggs and her nature walks. My next guests in the studio are Dove Gartenberg. He's here to talk about the NAMI family-to-family sessions that are being held this summer, and he's got two guests with him. So welcome back, Dove. I've had you in here before.
Great to be here. And okay. We have... our family-to-family program this summer, which is actually unusual. We've had such interest in the class. Family-to-family is a course for family members and caregivers of loved ones who are living with mental illness. And I'd like to introduce Debbie and Dick Fagnant, who just came back from a national training with the National Alliance of Mental Illness in the Washington, D.C. area. And they are now Alaska State Trainers for the Family-to-Family program. And they're going to talk a little bit about this summer's course.
Thank you, Dove.
Hi. Well, it was great to go to the training, to be with other NAMI members who, you know, their big goal was just to support people living with mental illness and to support their families. Was pretty exciting to spend a weekend with them. So we're working with the Family to Family class, and like Dove said, that it's a free class, and it has 12 sessions, and it's a program for family members of adults who are living with a mental illness. And it's really designed to help all family members understand their loved one better and to be able to support them while at the same time, you know, supporting, maintaining their own well-being.
Yeah, essentially what the program is that we'll be concentrating on having some skills workshops, which will involve some problem solving, and those will have an emphasis on acceptance of a problem. Problem that is certainly not going to be going away, but can be managed with the family support. We'll also have lectures on mental illness with discussion to help build a better understanding of a variety of illnesses and diagnoses, biology, and medicines.
And the course, it focuses on information on illnesses such as schizophrenia, bipolar, and major depression, but also includes the whole range of other mental illnesses.
Debbie, is this class offered? People may not know that this class is offered really around the country by NAMI affiliates. And why is that? Why is this class so well known around the country?
Well, it's really the signature program for NAMI, National NAMI. It's been offered since 1991, and there's over 300,000 people who have taken the class. So that's pretty cool. And there have been studies done on it. It was actually the University of Maryland Medical Center. They did a four-year study that was funded by the National Institute of Mental Health. And the cool thing about it is that they did, they ran control groups as well as groups that where the families had taken the family-to-family course. And so they were able to compare them and be an evidence-based program. And what they found out was that families who had taken the family-to-family class had significantly greater empowerment. They just felt better about themselves, about their family, about the services that were available, and about their community. They had a significantly greater knowledge of mental illness and a higher rating of coping skills. They also had a lower rating of anxiety, and that was related to being able to control the conditions in their lives. So it was exciting. Those results in themselves were exciting. But what was great was that, 6 months later, when they interviewed the same groups of people, they found that those effects were still in place. So, it's really the National Institute of Mental Health is accepting it as an evidence-based program, which is just great for families dealing with a mental illness.
Okay, Dove, and let everybody know when the class is going to be. I see here they're not going to reveal the location, unless you're.
Oh, we're going to reveal the location. Everyone's been waiting for this moment.
Okay.
The family class is starting this evening at the Juno Birth Center at 5:15. We figure that this show is probably too close for many people to take it, but we're going to offer it again in the fall. Starting October 20th,
right.
You go to our website at www.namijuno.org you'll see a tab for Family to Family, and that gives you a lot of information and timing when this is offered. So, but if you're really interested and want to come by to the class tonight, and we can get you signed up.
Okay, very good. Well, thanks all three of you for being our guests in the studio today.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
In 1991, I was an assistant ranger on the Walker Ranger District of the Chippewa National Forest in Minnesota. I was responsible for managing our campgrounds, which in the summer were filled with people from all over Minnesota and surrounding states, attracted to the wonderful walleye fishing on Leech Lake. One winter day, I was asked to address a gathering of employees about the conflicts I saw between my personal philosophy in life and Forest Service policy. Now, the first thing that came to mind was our forest's porcupine control policy. I pointed out that our law enforcement officer had to get written permission to carry his sidearm every time he went out to enforce our regulations on the National Forest. But if one of our employees wanted to shoot porcupines, all they had to do was check out our .22 pistol from the safe at the office and go kill porcupines out in the woods. It was a time-honored tradition in the Forest Service. Porcupines ate trees, sometimes a lot of them, and that was enough for those in the forestry profession to declare war on these animals. Now, I knew that porcupines were destructive to cabins, and where there are no natural predators, they could eliminate some species from hardwood forests like eastern hemlock. That, in turn, had effects on other species like deer. But I didn't think it right that we just kill porcupines simply because we didn't like the way they made their living. Well, I stepped up on my soapbox and I gathered steam. In fact, I said, deviating from my script, when I found out that we used live traps at our campgrounds to remove problem skunks, I thought that was a great alternative to just killing them. But then I learned that once we'd trapped the skunks, we'd drag the traps to the lake and drown them. Well, I'm telling you now that we're no longer going to do that. We are going to trap and transplant skunks from our campgrounds. No more killing. Now, one of my employees, Tom, was in the audience that day. He managed the daily goings-on at our campgrounds, and he asked me, "Have you ever released a skunk from a live trap before? Can you do it without getting sprayed?" "Well," I said, "I've never done it, but I know that people do it all the time," not really knowing if this was the absolute truth. Well, the next spring we opened our campground and the walleye fishermen showed up as usual. One day, while sitting in the office, I got a call on the radio from Tom. He was at the campground. "Pete, we caught the big stinker in a live trap last night." Well, the big stinker was a huge old skunk that had been getting bolder by the week at the campground. It had been terrorizing the campers, looking for food around the campsite, spraying dogs, and startling people walking around the campground after dark. But now it was in the live trap. "What do you want me to do with them?" he asked. Well, Tom knew doggone well what I'd said last winter, but I could tell he was reluctant. I took a deep breath. My credibility was at stake. "Well, hang on to him and don't touch the trap. I'll be right out." About a half hour later, I was at the campground. Tom and a couple of interested campers led me to the trap. Inside it, absolutely filling the wire cage, a magnificent skunk fidgeted, shifting its weight from one front paw to the other, daring us to do something. Its black fur was the color of midnight, a white stripe, the color of the top of a towering thunderhead cloud, began on its nose and continued over the head and down the back onto the tail. It was beautiful. While Tom and the audience stood back, well upwind, when I backed the truck up to the trap. But instead of wrestling the trap directly into the pickup, I just sat on the tailgate and talked to the skunk, in a tone far more soothing than I felt. I explained what I was going to do and where I was going to take it. As we were in the heart of the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, home to the Leech Lake Band of the Chippewa, I even used every word and phrase of Chippewa I knew. "Buju, Mishomas." "Greetings, Grandfather." "Pete, Indijnakaz." "My name is Pete." "Walker in Donjaba." "I live in Walker." "Genewind Ganawind Aki Gaedush Widakau Bimadizujig." "We take care of the earth and help people." "Mandwe Anamud." "The voice of the wind in the pines." "Minwajimo." "Telling a good story." "Wabshka Jikang." "White stump." "Chi Miigwech." "Great thanks." I tell folks that was all meant to ease the skunk's nerves, but it was just as much giving me time to build up my own courage. Very slowly, I carefully draped a blanket over the trap. The skunk eyed me with its beady little eyes, claws gripping the wire mesh of the trap. Still talking, I gently hoisted the trap into the bed of the truck, eased the tailgate closed, and slowly drove out of the campground, heading for some old farm fields on the National Forest about 15 miles away, a place that ought to be great habitat for wild skunks. When I got to my destination, I reversed the process and gently lowered the cage to the ground, talking all the time. I cautiously lifted the blanket from the trap. It was then I discovered that my plan had a serious flaw. Not only was I going to have to handle the trap to open the door to let the skunk out, but the door to the trap was spring-loaded, and I'd have to hold it open as the skunk exited. Thankfully, that was at the back end of the trap, out of the reach of its teeth, but it was also at the business end of the skunk. Well, I sprung open the door of the trap, but the skunk didn't move. It couldn't turn around in the trap, and I had a hunch it wasn't going to back up if it couldn't see what was going on back there. I was going to have to encourage it to back out. Well, I scrunched up my face, held my breath, squinted my eyes, picked up the trap, and tilted it up. The skunk hung onto the wire mesh tighter with its claws, refusing to back out of the trap into the unknown. I gently shook the trap. It hung on tighter. I tilted the trap up more and shook it again. Finally, it lost its grip and slipped out of the trap onto the ground. The skunk looked at me and whirled around. I was staring directly at its rear end. I closed my eyes and my mouth and froze in place, holding onto the trap. When nothing happened after a second, I opened my eyes just a little bit, just in time to see the skunk waddling into the tall grass. I let out my breath. We'd both escaped. I loaded the trap back into the truck and headed back to the campground. Tom saw me come in and approach the truck from well upwind, still not taking any chances. How'd it go? He asked. No problem, I said. You just have to know how to talk to him. Tom was still a bit skeptical, but if I could do it without any ill effects, he could too. We figured out a way to open the trap and latch the door open so a skunk could leave on its own, without having to be encouraged by tilting and shaking the trap. So we were set. We weren't going to kill any more skunks at our campgrounds. Now, I didn't think about it until years later, but when Tom had called from the campground asking me what to do with the skunk in the trap, it was really a leadership test. If I'd told him he had to risk releasing a live skunk without me ever having done it in the first place, my credibility as a supervisor would have suffered. It was a lesson that I never forgot over the remainder of my career in the Forest Service.
That was Pete Griffin with The Skunk Whisperer. He's Juneau's very own storytelling ranger. And now here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. Do you ever wonder where birds sleep? Let's listen as the last bird sounds of the day recede into nightfall. All birds need to sleep, or at least snooze, during each 24-hour period. Most sleep at night. Birds don't usually sleep in nests, except to incubate eggs or brood young. They search out a place to roost, often selecting the same place night after night. Songbirds find a protected perch, sheltered from rain and safe from nighttime predators. Small forest birds often spend the night huddled together in tree cavities. Woodpeckers cling to vertical tree trunks. Starlings mass into huge flocks that blanket the trees. Seabirds select islands or cliffs on which to snuggle in for the night. Ducks sleep while floating in protected bays. Birds don't actually tuck their heads under their wings to sleep, as we've been led to believe, but a bird may turn its head around and poke its beak under shoulder feathers to keep it warm. It's similar to the way we humans pull a quilt up to our nose during a cold winter's night. Do you think birds dream? If so, what do you think birds dream about? Let us know on Facebook. Search for Bird Note, all one word. I'm Mary McCann.
Thank you.
Tonight on 360 North, the BBC World News is at 7 with Alaska weather at 7:30. At 8, the animated collage Ingenuity reflects on Native Americans' shared past, turbulent present, and undiscovered future. This week's Native Report is at 8:30. The Alaska documentary Best of Kivgik 1994 is next at 9, followed at 10 by Manifest Destiny, Monsters to Destroy. Tonight on 360 North and 360north.org.
This is KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast on 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on the following translators in the Valley and Auk Bay, 276 AF, Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO, Gustavus listens K201 AM, K220 BT serves Hoonah and Excursion Inlet and Icy Straits is K210 AS. You can also get us on GCI Digital Cable, channel 871. It's been my pleasure hosting today, and I'll see you again tomorrow.
Civilians were reported killed in shelling attacks. Police claim they found 18 bodies of security forces outside Baghdad.